This is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and on this episode of Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about playtesting your game or adventure design. How do you do it? How much testing should you do? How much testing is too much? All that and more today on Wandering DMs. Right, Paul?
Too much. Is there such a thing as too much testing?
I don't know.
Yep.
There's certainly yes, such there a thing is. As not enough. Certainly such a thing as not enough.
I feel that, okay, this might be one of those episodes that winds up being therapy for Dan. And I've seen other people, maybe I'm not even thinking game design right now, but I've seen other people do too much a gold plating on a product. We have an ongoing joke when we do our Wargaming Saturday night streams that, you know, I've been working on this war game design for 30 years now.
I see. That is too much. That is too much, Dan.
So viewers, please help.
Yeah. So this is very timely for me because last night I was running a game of Fearful Ends for some friends of mine. Happened to be a friend's birthday and asked me to come run a game for them, and I said, sure, do you mind if I force you to play test Fearful Ends? So just did that, and I think, I don't know how many DMs out there watching do this. Maybe this is just specific to folks who are running stuff at conventions rather than running home campaigns, but if you have a module you love, whether it's something you wrote or something that you just really enjoy running, you should absolutely run it for multiple groups. It is amazing, I think, how different the experience can be and the information you get back. However, I will say, I always go into that with this notion of like a very scientific idea of like, oh, well, this is like experimentation, right? I'm going to get different data from different groups. And I'm going to figure out how to refine and edit my adventure to be even better. And then they're so different. You're so right. Desperate that I don't, there's like, there's no, how do I even make a comparison? I have like one data point here and one data point back over here behind my back. Like,
totally.
Give me
an example of what has happened that you couldn't possibly compare.
Well, here's the funny one. Let me tell you about last night. And for anybody who's played or hopes to play in any of my convention games, spoiler alert, I'm going to be talking about the scenario Closed for Swimming, which I've ran just last night, and I've run only once or twice actually at convention so far. So in the scenario, it's a modernish Cthulhu scenario, and the players are in a beach town, and they start off in this town meeting because there's a bunch of shark attacks, and they're trying to figure out, you know, how do we get the beach reopened? It takes the premise from the original premise from Jaws, which I find to be very timely these days. Accidentally, this was not intentional, but there's a undercurrent in the movie Jaws of this friction between, you know, it's not safe, we can't let people go out and swim when there are sharks in the water, versus all of our businesses are suffering because the beaches are closed, and so you know, everyone's no one can make a living because all the businesses have to close. Right. Yeah. Sound familiar? Anyone? Yeah. So the troubles of lockdown. So that's the premise. And it begins with there's a lot of stuff presented to them in that opening scene when they're in this meeting, a lot of different places that they can go investigate. There's something strange going on at the local ice cream shop. There's something unusual happening down at the radio station. There's something unusual down at the boat rental place, and I have all these different characters who speak up during this initial meeting to sort of present little teasers, little hooks for the players to potentially go investigate. As they do so, a lot of the evidence points to the ocean, and at some point they're going to want to get on a boat and go out there in the ocean. So the two times I've run this before, that's generally what happens. The players go to different locations in different orders, or sometimes they skip one or not the other, but that's fine. That's what I like. I like to have a little more content than the players could possibly engage with, right? But it has this ramp up of them kind of like, oh, it's an interesting mystery. This is kind of a trope in Cthulhu, right? This interesting mystery, and as we're unraveling it, we got pushed into this direction of something that's actually truly dangerous and horrific. The group last night, they decided, well, there's definitely something off about this shark attack thing. We think there aren't really sharks, and we're worried about the businesses going under. So we're going to prove that it is, in fact, safe, they decide. We're not going to go investigate what's going on. We're just going to prove that actually the water is perfectly safe, because we have a character who's a scuba diver, and we have a character who's a television personality and has a cameraman with them, and we have a character who's works at a boat rental place and has access to a boat. So we're going to get on the boat, we're going to drive out into the, or, you know, boat out onto the ocean. This guy's going to jump in the water, dive into the water, and we're going to film him, and we're going to present, look, totally safe, you should open everything up. And of course, that's where all the horrific things are, is out in the ocean. So they basically jump past all the content in the video. They were like, let's go straight to the end of the game, please. And just screw all that. We're just gonna gotcha. Jump into the water and see the horrors. Yeah. So I was like, what? This is like all this content that I'm trying to tune and tweak, like they just skipped it. They didn't do it at all.
Yep.
And I'm on the fly having to do stuff, which I generally do, which I like, right? I like to improvise at my games. And so I'm having to do stuff where I'm like, well, this clue is normally over here, but they went this way instead. So how can I reincorporate the information in a different way and present it to them? So they still get the clue about what's going on, but in a different way, right?
Right.
So like in one case, maybe if they went to the radio station, they would find a fax that got sent to the radio station. And then in this case, like, well, maybe the fax was actually sent from the boat. So maybe maybe there's a copy of the original fax there, you know, and I'm kind of like trying to do that, trying to give them some of the clues, in different ways, deliver it in different ways, even though they're somewhere else, which is weird.
It's funny because you're making me think of an adventure that I had made and have never publicized. Involving an underground Coatoan community in a giant underground lake. And when I wrote it, the things that I designed specifically was like an entry point to the giant underground lake, and then how to navigate, and then the king's quarters, and then a temple beyond that with a thing. And along the way, I just dropped some hints about, well, there are other communities here with like princes and dukes, and they have a bunch of factions, and some are competing against the king. And so I ran this maybe about three games or conventions or whatever. And at one of the convention games, people that I was meeting for the first time, they immediately were like, well, we're definitely going to go to one of the competing princes and get his assistance to overthrow the king. And I'm like, prepared none of that. Prepared for absolutely zero, none of that. And then the remaining 3 hours was entirely improvised from stem to stern. What is it about underground? What is it about underwater adventures, Paul, that makes them go completely?
Let me put up, John Miller has a comment here for us. It says, that's one thing about Dungeon or even Hex Crawl. It's hard to skip to the end, but city-based scenarios are less constrained in that way. Do you think that's true, Dan? Do you think that this is specific to more open-ended, location or point crawls, as we might call them, rather than a dungeon? Can you have this problem in a dungeon?
I think John's right. You're 100%. That's a really great point. And for me, I was in a wilderness-y type situation, right, where it was, you know, open-ended and you can basically go anywhere. So that's a great point, and that's one of the strengths, and Joshua was talking to us a week or two back about the same things. One of the strengths of the dungeon environment is that it really focuses possibilities for both the DM's end and the player's end as well.
Yeah.
By restricting the number of possibilities, it focuses you on what's available a little bit better. So maybe though, maybe a dungeon adventure would be more suitable for refinement and testing the way that we're thinking.
Maybe. Now, certainly the way I design my dungeons, because I don't want them to feel super linear, is that usually there are many paths that one can take through it.
Yeah.
In fact, one of my favorite dungeons has an objective of, it's in a cliffside, and the objective is to find a route to the top. And there are, in fact, three in the dungeon. So there's many ways that the players can succeed. So I think, they might not skip to the end, but you're still going to get stuff where players go very different routes and encounter very different stuff.
And but you might just have three is a lot different than coming up with something that I'd never even anticipated in my wildernessy type adventure.
But players can still throw you for a loop just with how they interact with the stuff that's there, right? Like I remember a situation where I was playing with a group and they were in a dungeon, and there's a lich in the dungeon, which I'm thinking is going to be like the big exciting boss fight at the end. And the players encounter him, and one of the players just immediately kind of prostrates himself in front of the lich and says, like, I want to be your student. I want to learn from you. Be my master, etc. Teach me the ways of lichdom, which was delightful. But it was sort of like, oh, is this taking the wind out of the ending of my scenario here? I don't know.
And there's a lot, right? I feel like I hear a lot of stories about, like, you know, beast comes out of the woods and goes after the party, and one of the players really, really, really wants to make friends with it and make a pet out of it. I feel is a thing that happens a lot nowadays. Yeah. So be on the lookout for that as well. There, but even so, at least the lich, right? You knew that it was in the game. And now that is a thing you can add a note to if, you know, in your notes, like if the players want to make a treaty with the lich, then here's the general scope of what they might do. So that would be helpful and on topic.
Sure. Yeah, I guess that's true. And I'm not saying that, you know, that there's no value in playtesting just because my players jumped to the end in this one scenario. I still think that I learned a lot about the game and the mechanics and the scenario itself and what works and what doesn't. And it's fun, honestly. I think that's part of the fun. I would say that it's part of the fun for me as DM, because this question was posed to me. People like to ask this question, right? Of like, why do you DM? What is fun about DMing? And for me, one of the things that is fun is seeing how differently some of these games can run when I run the same game multiple times.
Now I might respond to that question with why is that a priority for you?
I don't, you know, it's a good question, but I mean, you and I have said many times,
fun,
right?
That what does that delight. Have to do with it?
You, what? Well, you and oh, jeez. Let's not get into that.
Fun? I don't recognize that. What are you?
You and I have both said in the past, I think, that we love it when players take us by surprise, right? When they go, when they make a left turn and take the scenario in a direction that we never imagined, right? Like, that's some of the joy of DMing is that.
Yeah.
And so and I that's certainly a great challenge. Incorporate. Yeah. And that is the challenge, right? And I enjoy putting stuff in the scenarios I write to enable that. Right, I like putting open-ended content in my games. I like putting a character like a lich who maybe is going to listen to somebody when they say, you know, be my master. But then does putting that kind of open-ended stuff into your game that enables you to do more improv on the spot, does that ruin our ability to playtest and refine?
I got to admit, so now that we're talking about it, I feel maybe, you know, following John Miller's point, you know, maybe a more restricted and frankly, what I think of in testing in terms of role playing games, I do think of like a more restricted situation of either a fairly limited, you know, dungeon level. I don't think there's any point in, you know, playtesting an entire campaign world, probably playtesting a mega dungeon. I mean, almost no one manages to even publish a mega dungeon, never mind playtest it multiple times. And James Malajewski's made that point a number of times, is that even while I'm working on it, the thing is evolving all the time, and it's literally never the same thing twice. So for me, I got to admit, I think about testing smaller slices of the game. So for me, I think about testing a monster or one magic item, or if I'm working on a war game, that's a much more boxed in situation. Is I'm going to have two armies coming at each other with a specific win condition, and the two people will be competing. And the question there is basically, can I price balance the different units, or in a card game, or something like that? So for me, a lot of the time, now we're leaning into the conversation about, are things like challenge ratings useful? And I know a lot of people badmouth them, but I feel that having some kind of challenge rating E type thing attached to monsters is helpful as a very rough guideline. And of course, like we're talking about here, there's so many different ways that players can come up the game, and so many different class powers and spells and strategies and tactics that, there'll almost always be some kind of perfect way to defeat the encounter, and that's great. But I do feel that I like having, for me, I'm not so interested in having a perfectly balanced encounter, but I am interested in what should the XP reward be afterwards? And it has to be something. And I am certainly interested in, gauging that risk level so that I can give a reasonable XP award, for example, or know how much treasure is reasonable to attach to that. So that's what I'm usually thinking about with my testing is, and I've said a number of times on my blog, I think, that creating a new object in a game, a monster, a spell, a magic item, a card, whatever, is only 20% of the work. And the hard part, the 80% of the work, is testing and price balancing where it fits in with the rest of the game. And I know not everybody agrees with that, but that has been my attitude for a long time.
The interesting thing to me is, of course, I came to this conversation with just my experience last night running this horror game. And in that game, in horror games in general, I would say, I'm never thinking about experience. I'm never thinking about treasures. And I'm rarely thinking about the difficulty of combats, because the combats are all too difficult on purpose.
Okay.
Right? Right? The things that the players are encountering are meant to be much too deadly for them, and they should run away in terror. That's the point of horror. So it's fascinating. I will say this, though. I agree with your concept of trying to limit the scope down of what you're testing. And as I think about what am I getting the value of testing in a horror campaign or horror scenario, is not the path through and how they connect the clues and how they get from one place to another, but the specific locations. If I boil it down to just the locations, sure, this group didn't go to the ice cream shop, but they did go to the ocean. And that is a location that all my groups went to. They all went to the ocean. And so what kind of questions did they ask? And what things am I missing from my quick, easy to look up notes?
Yep.
You know, would they, this group asked for, what is the meaning of this acronym on the side of the boat or something like that. And I'll go, I didn't write that down. That should be in front of my face so that when they ask that question, I don't have to go digging. Right.
Right. Right.
So it's a lot of stuff like that, I think.
There are some great comments that I gotta pick up on. So, William just said, it seems like, oh my goodness, what great conversation. So William just said, it seems like the goal of playtesting is maybe, and we're thinking like challenge rating type things, is maybe less about making it perfect, or at least I am, less about making it perfect and more about finding overlooked doomsday scenarios. And I think that's a great, point. And I heard, Frank Mentzer a while back talking about one of the places that the creators of original D&D really fouled up was the carrion crawler monster with its eight paralyzing tentacles that don't actually do any damage. And it's an interesting case because like in the Monster Mark system that appeared in White Dwarf magazine at one point, that's the kind of thing that totally breaks the system, is that system is totally based on take the, expected damage per round, right? That's a common assessment. Take the average damage per round and do some kind of math to it. And if you make a monster that on the one hand does zero damage per round, and at the same time can wipe out an entire party in one round and render them incapacitated, that tends to break those kinds of attempts at point-based systems. And so even if you're not talking challenge ratings, right, original D&D has monster levels, right? Has monster level tables. What level are you likely to show up on? And yeah, they really glitched up the carrion crawlers, and is originally it shows up in a very low level table, and then you switch to first edition, and that's the monster that actually made the biggest adjustment in monster level tables. And they totally didn't realize initially exactly how perilous that was. And there's a little piece of text in the AD&D monster manual. It says carrion crawlers are greatly feared. And there's a reason for that. It's like they put them on the wrong level table, frankly.
That's great.
So I think that's a good point about just trying to, you know, there might be something that you overlook, like how powerful a vampire is, like we were talking about last week.
Yeah, I think the idea of stuff that's overlooked is definitely key there. I'm not sure that it necessarily needs to be doomsday level stuff, right? Yeah, yes, that's bad. Yeah. Yes, I want to eliminate stuff that's just going to accidentally completely wipe the party and disrupt the whole game. But also just stuff that's going to screw up the pacing, right? Stuff that's like, oh, no, I forgot. I didn't think about this, and the players asked for this thing, and now I got to go dig through my notes, and the whole game kind of gets interrupted for 5 minutes. Like, that's stuff I want to find, too. I want to find stuff like that, so that the next time I'm a little better prepared. If somebody does something similar, I can, you know, smoothly integrate that into the game, whatever it is they're talking about, and push along.
Yes, very much so. And the other thing that has scrolled off at this point is, I believe John a couple minutes ago was asking, like, how much testing did they do for original D&D? Which is a really interesting question, right? And I'll say one thing I noticed is that in our foundational document Chainmail, right, it does say early on, it says these rules have been thoroughly playtested over a period of many months. Right, which of course I blush and shame at myself. So at least, that's a limited war game, right? That's a clear boxed-in scenario on your sand table, and you've got five types of terrain, and you have a limited number of units, and you're clearly marching at two armies at each other to destroy each other, and that's clearly a very limited number of things that could possibly happen, and there may be a number of months counts as solid playtesting. I saw another person who is still currently at Wizards, who really ought to know these kinds of things, who claims there was very, very little playtesting in original D&D, or the numbers of things. And so I saw them writing, the policy was basically make up some numbers and diddle with them until the game plays the way that you want, was the philosophy, as far as he can tell. And particularly for a wide-ranging role-playing game like Arneson and Gygax were playing, I don't see any other way that you can do that for all the reasons that you just mentioned, Paul.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, I think it's very poignant to bring up stuff like Mega Dungeons, right? Do we really think that any published Mega Dungeon was thoroughly playtested? Is that even possible? That would take years, I would think, right? That would take years. Have to zoom in. You have to zoom in. You have to play test little individual elements and then hope that the whole stitches together in a pleasing way, I think.
I will say that, so, you know, the early, you know, so like the early adventures, right, the early module adventures for AD&D and so forth, we know that they originally, you know, were used in tournaments. So you get, 20 or 30 tables or whatever of people testing these adventures in tournaments and then turned into actual publications for campaigns. We/I have wrestled with that, you know, production channel for years. Does a tournament game really work in a campaign? Is it reasonable? Is it too deadly? But clearly to begin with, they had a large amount of testing. And I noticed maybe in the late 80s or 90s that at one point they had playtester credits on adventures, that entirely went away around the late 80s, 90s. I wasn't seeing that playtesting credit anymore. Once they rolled out the core rule books to like third edition, fifth edition D&D, now there you have these giant thousands of names, credits of playtesters, which looks very good, at least for the core rule books. So I feel like that thing for the publisher of D&D, I feel like that's roller coastered up and down over the years.
Yeah. Yeah, and I feel like these days there's a lot of pride in the amount of playtesting that goes in, and even yes. just look at now about the announcement right. of the new edition of D&D that's coming out years in yep. advance, which I presume is all about. Yeah, I presume that's all about broadcasting right. the idea that yes, this thing is coming, and we're going to be testing the crap out of it.
Right,
right. Certainly, right. they tested the crap out of 5th. I remember D&D right. Next, as it was called right. then, being kind of in the works for a long time.
I like Steven's point here, saying that he gets the impression that Gygax was testing the concept of this new kind of game, and I can see that. Hmm. Right. And John's saying old TSR products completed by freelancers were rarely or never playtested. And I certainly, you know, have heard stories of, like, the Quagmire Adventure. I think you've used that before, Paul. Mm-hmm. And I think, was that by Dave Cook, or was that by somebody else? No, I'm hazy on that. But I remember them saying that they only had a month to churn those publications out. They had to get a page count and a word count, and they had the whole thing had to start and finish within 4 weeks. Nice. And that they clearly did not have time in that 80s push for more product to properly test stuff. Yeah, Rasmus, thank you very much, John.
It's really interesting. You know, we kind of blended across here, but the idea of testing scenarios or modules versus testing rules is a big difference.
Right.
In fact, right. you know, funny thing is, the group I was playing for last night included a wide range of both ages and experience levels with role playing, including somebody who was their right. second time ever role playing. And there was one person I was talking to who, you know, I mentioned we're playtesting this new system that I hope to publish soon. And when he was asking me questions towards the end about the publishing, it took a while for him to realize that there was a difference between, he was like, are you publishing the scenario versus the rules?
Yeah.
You know, it took a while for him to realize that these were two separate things.
Great.
These were two separate things great. And that one great, might great. Be published without the other.
Great. Yeah. That's a really good point. And I'm comfortable, you know, wanting rigorously tested core rules and then saying, okay, your adventure is like, go crazy, kids. who knows what's going to happen there? And I'm comfortable having this substrate of, you know, things that I'm confident about how to handle. And then in an adventure being, you know, fine, if you launch off into craziness, I know that I can come back when I need to and rely on the core rules have been tested when something, you know, reasonably concrete happens. So I'm personally very fine with that distinction. And I think some people might be surprised, like when I run a game, because I spend so much time, like on my blog and here, talking about testing and rules and mechanics and numbers. And then when the actual game starts, it's like, like everything's on fire. I don't know what's going on at that point.
That's very funny.
You know, I'd like to take a little side tangent, Paul, because sometimes I feel that you and I have slightly different perspectives about the testing issue because of our slightly different experiences with the video game industry. And so when I got started a couple years before you did in video games, which was the prior millennium, embarrassingly, but we were still in the age of, you know, mass boxed product. Mm-hmm. And so where I started out, the games that we were producing, to get them to market, we had to burn them to a CD. We had to print them in a box, and it had to get sent out nationwide to stores specifically for Christmas. So we had a hard deadline, like around Thanksgiving, as the game had to be locked down. It had to be tested. It had to be suitable for human consumption. We had a big QA department on staff. We had like 20 or 30, you know, part-time QA testers testing the game for months. And we really felt like we were going to have a lot of egg on our face if we shipped those 20,000 boxed copies out. In the era prior to internet distribution, and we really mm-hmm. had to get a solid product out for people under their tree on Christmas, and we couldn't, there were no tech-vaxies. And then you fast forward, and when you and I were working together, we did have at that point an online game, and you've been working in that in that vein ever since, of an online game that could be updated at will by the company. And so it was a big mental shift for me to say, we don't have any QA department. We just push stuff out. And if we discover that it needs to get modified, we can just, the players will tell us, the paying players will tell us, and we'll update it on the fly over the web. And yeah, that was a really big mental shift for me.
There's some really fascinating practices these days around that. Like, yeah, I've worked for companies in the past that do what they call A/B testing, where they specifically will segment the population of the game, of the population playing the game, into groups A and B, whatever you name it, whatever the heck you want, and then they might ship a new feature just to A, and say, okay, this and A might be only 10% of the population of the people playing the game, just to see, how does it work? Is it well received? Are there any problems? Right. This is our basically our live testing. Okay. 10% of the population actually has the change, and this is the test, right? This is the test. Right. And then we can directly compare. Okay. How did they perform versus the rest of the players who didn't have this feature and have been playing all along without it? You know, what did they like? How did they, you know, what did they buy? How did they, you know, how did they progress through levels? Whatever it is you're trying to test, whatever your metric is for figuring out success. And then, you know, if it's poor, then you just pull it back and you say, nope, this feature's gone. Sorry, everybody. And only 10% of the population is actually upset about that, maybe. Or if it's good, then you flip it on for everyone. Now everyone has it. And the 10% are like, sweet, we are, you know, we're the special group that got it early. Sure. Great.
Are you thinking like, are those mobile games that you're working on mostly now, or are those other platforms?
Those, that kind of testing was done largely on mobile games. Yes.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Fascinating. Yeah. Now, John Miller's got a good point that an example like Cyberpunk 2077 seems to have shown there's a limit to what the public will accept in terms of releasing a buggy product. And that's a good example. Other things historically, like Battle Cruiser 3000 AD, I think it was called, had that problem. I think that Daikatana had that problem. Yeah, I'm showing my age with really old video games.
I don't want to present either that like it's now the Wild West and we just turn shit on willy nilly. That's not true, right? Certainly, internal testing is done. You know, we try to make sure that the feature is solid. But the real question is like, what is this feature going to do to the game overall? Is it actually going to improve the game? And what does even improve mean? Right. Right. Is it more fun? That's your favorite one, right? Is it more fun? Do the players pay us more? Right.
Let me get my calculator here. Yeah,
it's more fun. Yeah. Right. Right. Do they play for more hours? Was that the goal for them, to play more hours? Do they play for less hours?
Right.
I don't know. Do they rate us
maybe
higher?
They get
on
satisfied
the score
sooner.
More five star ratings. Right. That's a good metric. The players are happy.
But it's interesting that you're talking, you know, we're talking about, you know, testing fairly small limited features, right? Not an entire scenario in those kinds of cases. And that's the kind of thing that I feel it's reasonable, in theory at least, to, you know, get metrics and get data about how it's performing. And like a whole campaign or a whole scenario is harder to get your arms around. Now, obviously, we're not all video game developers, and we're not all wizards producing D&D that have the capacity to push something out to possibly thousands of players for feedback. So we, you know, when we're doing our role playing, we are indie gamers and we have four or five people at the table. Maybe if we get really ambitious, we run a couple games online or we take it to a convention traditionally.
I would say that's like for testing for individuals who are writing their own game content, their own RPG content. I would say my biggest piece of advice is go to the conventions, right? Take your stuff to a convention. It's a great place to play test your stuff. You know, you can run the same thing a couple of times for totally different groups. And make sure you schedule yourself some time at the end for gathering feedback. A lot of times we let our games run right up to the wire. And everybody's like, you know, scrambling to get on to their next game. And I would say make sure you leave a little time there at the end to just chat with the players and say, what did you like? What worked? What didn't work?
That's killer. That's actually killer.
Yeah.
How polished do you feel like you need an adventure in before you take it to a convention?
I mean, it's got to be runnable, right? I can't. Yeah. I have to be able to run the thing. But the game that I ran last night is largely in my head, I would say, that I have about 3 to 4 pages of notes, and they're very kind of just bullet points, and it's very rough. It is certainly not a thing I would publish as is.
Yeah, yeah. So it's interesting, like where, when do you start? Well, I don't know. I got problems, Paul. That's why I ask. You know what, Paul? I'm getting data on what other people say they need to polish the adventure before they start testing it. That's what I'm currently testing.
Here's the interesting thing I will say. I feel like the more I write content for RPGs, the more I realize that I really kind of want two formats, because that format of like very, very short, very condensed notes, I find to be super helpful when I'm running the game. And however, like there's a lot of thought that's a lot of things that are in my head. And so for me to actually communicate that to someone else so that they can run the game, I need a lot more prose, right? But I worry then that now I've handed them this giant chunk of prose and they're going to have a much harder time running it at the table. And I feel like probably what I want is both. That I probably want to publish a thing where I say, here's all the long prose so that you can get all the notions and all the concepts and all the things of the elements of the game. And then here's your like 3 pages of quick notes for actually running the damn thing at the table.
Do you feel that runs up against the principle of don't repeat yourself? Any piece of data should be in only one place of your system. With the concern being if then you make some kind of modification later on, you might do it in place A and forget to do it in B. And now you've got your text contradicting itself.
Yep.
Is that a risk?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's definitely a risk, I would say. Yeah, I don't know how to solve that. But I will say, like, I think I have works that I've published where I, you know, after the fact, I look at what I've published and I'm like, well, I wouldn't want this in front of me while I'm running a game. And I feel like that's maybe, you know, not great that I'm presenting things for sale that are not what I want, right? Like, that's not fantastic. Now, maybe the real answer is what I need is like long prose, and then you need to like sit down and write your own notes, because I did this with somebody else's module and it worked way better. I don't know. I'm always ready and willing to do that level of work.
Right. We talked about this a number of times about where to dial in the level of detail or extent of text. And, you know, again, the dial goes back to, you know, Gygax's original Greyhawk, which is one line per room, literally one line per room. The whole thing fits on 15 lines for one level, up to, like, I feel for me, like the longest thing I ever saw was Temple of Elemental Evil. Like one room goes on pages and pages and pages. You know, and obviously initially drafted by Gygax and then actually published by Frank Mentzer. And that is like, oh my God, that's so far too long, guys.
Yeah, that's really tough, I think, because generally what I like is to have enough of the room in my head that I can give my own spin on what it looks like. And then I can have all the details readily accessible, so as the players interact with the environment and ask questions, I can pull those out and be like, oh yeah, oh, you know, I want to, you know, what does the artwork look like? Oh, okay, well, it looks like this, right? And that's hard. That's hard. Like, you have to really be intimately knowledgeable of all the details to be able to do both of those things. I've seen a lot of, I feel like we're straying in our topic a lot, but I feel like I've seen some adventures recently that try to solve this problem with interesting formatting, right? We'll do things with like highlights or different colors or whatnot to like pop out the important details of room. So you can glance quickly and be like, boom, boom, boom. Okay. Those are the important bits. And then you can also then like read more closely and dig up the more detailed information as needed.
Right.
Yeah.
Now to bring it, that's a good point. So to bring it back maybe closer to our testing conversation, like, and I'm so glad. So Paul is the one that suggested this topic, and I'm so delighted that he did, because it's something that's so close to me. I wouldn't think to bring it up, frankly. It's like it's like my skin. I wouldn't think to start talking about it. It's with me all the time, like a fish in water. But of course, I spend a lot of time thinking about how to test, game rule designs. And, if anybody that follows my blog, I have, what I wind up doing is I wind up writing code to make a computer simulation for a game, such as D&D Combat or my Book of War war game or the Bismarck war game. Or I actually made a simulator for the board game Game of Life because my partner Isabel was making an art project where she was converting the Game of Life to talk about immigration issues. And so, granted that I'm not, I'm not Wizards and I can't push it out in front of 10,000 people, I felt like a pretty good step in that direction was to write a computer simulator for the game, whichever one I'm talking about, and, have that run it a billion times and get some kind of result about what tends to happen. For the Game of Life, we could dial up what the, what the awards were, what the penalties were, depending on how many people we felt should win or go bankrupt along the course of the game. And I felt like I've gotten a lot of value out of that. I've gotten a lot of value not trying to, entirely just guess what the resource values of units should be in games. And, so I've got that in my blog right at the moment. I have some links on our YouTube description of this episode. And at one point, I even gave a talk at Johns Hopkins U to a game design course on that. And that's my top recommendation if someone's got coding skills to do that.
Are you only testing the really crunchy bits like this? Like, do you ever try to formulate ways to test the social interactions or the... Like you talked about the notion of this group trying to ally themselves with some other NPC group. I can't remember that Duke or something you were talking about.
Right.
Like, is that stuff testable?
I don't know how. I mean, so crunchy bits only for me. I mean, the crunchy bits are the parts you can crunch. Now we're just debating definitions, Paul. We've got a Wittgenstein problem here. I don't know how. I mean, that's the two different difference. I'm happy to have, ironed out crunchy bits that I'm comfortable and feel like I can handle. And then the social bits, that's the part that's going to surprise me every time. And that's why it's interesting to run.
Yeah, I feel like there's still the social bits are still testable, at least in terms of running it multiple times and discovering the holes, right? Where are just like people pointing out plot holes, right? Like, you ever have that? Like a player point out like, but this NPC shouldn't know this thing, or this NPC couldn't possibly have done this thing that he's claiming to have done. And you go, oh no, there's actually a plot hole in my writing. Oops.
I'll say that I feel like I see that in a number of movies, right? I was just thinking about three movies just last night that are all like interesting and I like them. And then in the last act, they have to have a climax and the climax is kind of not entirely believable. So there was some little thing to arrange that. So I'm certainly spotted that kind of stuff myself before.
Yeah.
So but Paul, when I run an adventure, it's bulletproof. What are you talking about?
I'm definitely hoping when playtesting, and this is pure luck, I think. There's no technique to this, but I'm hoping to expose that kind of stuff, right? That I want to run the game in such a way that the players will point that stuff out and I'll go, and then the real trick, the thing that I always forget to do is when that happens, is to take a moment to write down a note to myself for later of like, hey, remember, the players found this hole and you better fix it.
So Eric Worldender here has a comment saying that he playtested an adventure earlier this year, one you were running for the second time, and found testing how well the NPC motivations and personalities came across was really useful. That's good data there, Eric. Thank you for that. The other thing I'll say is that for me, personally, because it's part of my, professional life as well, teaching math and computing, is that every day I'm trying to hammer to my first time introductory computing students, you've got to test it. You've got to test your software. You've got to test it. And, for many of us, that's just obvious. Of course, you're going to do that. But for, first time people that have never dealt with, creating systems, that is mind-blowing. And for some of them, they have, for some of us, it would just be intuitive. Like, I'm going to run it two or three times and the results are right. But yeah. that step is not intuitive to everybody. And I even have some math students that I taught, every day I talk about how you're going to double check this one. How are you going to double check that one? And I do have some, more challenged students at the end of the semester go, I never got that checking bit that you were talking about all the time. I just never grokked what you were talking about ever.
Fascinating.
And it's interesting how easy it is to overlook that.
It's not just students, I'll say, Dan. I've worked at large video game companies and heard the CTO stomping down the hallway yelling, "That's your shit! That's your shit!" I see that. I've seen practices too where the when you submit your code into version control that you must include a note of how did you test it.
Yep.
Just to prove that you did.
Right. And of course there are paradigms like, test driven development where you write the tests first before you write the code. And I'm not, requiring my students to do that, but you gotta test it at some point.
I've had some really good experiences doing test-driven development. And so now I'm wondering, how can I bring that into my role-playing? How do I do test-driven scenario development?
How would you possibly do test-driven development in a role-playing game, Paul? I don't know, man.
It must be possible, right? It must be possible.
I don't know. No, I don't see that. That'd be fascinating. If anybody sees how to do that, please tell us.
We'll have a new
game design development paradigm. Did you have fun?
I'm imagining you're trying to develop the test first before you've developed the game. So you sit down and you're everybody ready to play? Yeah. How do we play? I don't know. I haven't written the rules yet. Did you have fun? No. All right. Well, the test failed.
Perfect. No, it's fine.
No, so you make rules that make you change it. So you say yes.
N-A-N.
Oh, dear. Are there other methods other than trial by fire? Have you ever done anything like... I'm thinking of... There's a specific case... and this wasn't for developing rules, but for when I first got the latest edition of Warhammer Fantasy roleplay, I think fourth edition, combat was complicated, very complicated. And I was having a lot of trouble grokking how it worked. So I literally sat down and made a couple of dummy characters and ran by myself a couple of combats and just played them multiple times. Just so that I could understand, this is how that works. This is how that works. And then I think wrote some blog posts about like, aha, I figured it out. Here's the information. Here's where the text is confusing and how you can, figure out what I figured out here. And included pictures and text about the tests that I ran. So I think that's
really
helpful.
I've done that too. Now, Paul has an incredibly popular video on YouTube called "Can I Play D&D Alone Solo?" And I've seen that can be helpful for DMs to get ready for games, to run a small scenario to see how it's going to work out in advance. Yeah. And I've done the same thing, and I have found that to be quite helpful, actually.
Or just to give yourself familiarity with a mechanic you haven't used before, right?
Right.
You know, if you're running Savage Worlds and you've never used their chase mechanic and you think you might use it in an upcoming game, just sit down and make a dummy one and run through it a couple times. It can be really, really illuminating.
There is a risk, right? There's a risk that the DM is going to accidentally become too much of an expert at the scenario, and they're going to steamroller the players who are learning it for the first time. And I've had that, and that actually has come up at least once or twice on our Book of War Saturday show, actually, that I'm like, I only looked at the results of a billion of these. I'm sorry.
I thought you were referring to jousting there. That wasn't a comment.
That was the next clause, Paul. The next clause was going to be about jousting, exactly. And
If you're ever in an OD&D game with Dan and there's an opportunity to joust, don't do it. Get the hell out of there. No, fireball, see ya.
And there, see, there you go. See, like that. So watch out for that. Don't, you know, don't drive it into the ground. Don't drive your testing in the ground as a DM. You know, don't become sick of it. When should you, you know, so there's a phrase, that I've heard of real artists ship, right? Real artists actually get the thing out to the people. And you know, I had, you know, back when I had bands, I had, you know what, I don't know whether I should say the name or not, but I had lovely people in a band that we shared a rental space with, and they were just such wonderful musicians, and they gold plated it too much, and they had an album that they were working on, and they worked on it for a year, and then they were like, well, we just need to re-record the whole thing, and they re-recorded it, and the problem was the more that they learned about their own piece, the more that they could see tiny, minute little things that were irritating them that surely no one else in the entire world would possibly spot. When do you make the call? When do you make the call and just say, I'm done with this and I'm going to put it on DM's Guild or something like that? How do you know when you're done?
I don't know. I almost feel like for me, it always goes the other way around. I'm just like, I have this deadline. Let me do as much testing as I can up until that point, and then cross my fingers and hope it was enough.
So maybe what I'm hearing is you've got to set a deadline.
You've got to set a deadline
in advance and just stick to that.
Yeah. I think so. I mean, you know, as best you can, I guess I would say. I mean, I tried to do that with Fearful Ends, and my deadline was going to be actually the end of this month, and that's clearly not happening. So you can readjust, you can reevaluate. No, that deadline was unrealistic. I'm going to change it. Just don't let yourself do it too much, right? If you keep doing it over and over and over again, eventually then there are no deadlines.
And even so, and Eric's pointing out, of course, that we are, there's this thing called the internet, I'm heard, that I think I can connect my computer to now. You know, even on DM's Guild or DriveThruRPG, you can upload revisions, and people do that. Yeah. And it's very, very, I find that very valuable as a customer there, actually. So you do have the opportunity to learn and refine.
I've certainly done that with pretty much everything I've listed up there. Is inevitably somebody finds something. Somebody always is going to find something. You're never going to find all of it. I think that's the thing, right? I've had works where I've hired professional editors to go through my work, and I posted it up there, and still somebody finds something. They're like, "What? Didn't you edit?" I'm like, "Yes, of course I edited."
Fascinating. Oh, that's fascinating. I'm glad.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
It's just, I've seen someone write the very best way to spot a typo is to spend 3 months editing, revising, reviewing, actually release it, and then look at it the very next morning. And that is when you are guaranteed that you're going to find a bunch of typos and grammar mistakes. Yeah. The 5 minutes the next morning after you release it.
I will say I found super valuable if you can do it, if you have a large enough network, a really valuable test, I think, if you're writing game content, especially writing your own scenarios, is to pass it off to someone else to run. Get someone else to do your test for you.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not just like, now I don't have to test myself. Great. You know, less work for me. No. Still run your own game and still test it yourself, but get somebody else to run it is really fascinating. You'll get a whole raft of different kinds of information than you get from testing it yourself.
And specifically, you'll get feedback on, I love that. And you'll get feedback on, is this the right amount of detail? Is it too little detail that I don't know what's going on, or is it too much detail that I'm getting lost in it? And of course that'll vary for different people, but you'll at least get some feedback about whether you've hit the right amount of detail and organization or not.
Yep.
That's also really killer. We should do more of that. We really got to do more of like handing off our adventures to other people to run and see how that worked.
Is that a dig?
No, it's a wonderful opportunity, Paul. A wonderful opportunity. This is gold, and we got to move on it.
Excellent. We are just about out of time here, Dan. Do you have any final thoughts on playtesting?
I'm in favor of it, Paul.
good.
I'm pro testing.
Yeah. As am I. I just think you have to be realistic with yourself and don't beat yourself up too much. That like it's not gonna make your work bulletproof, right? Like it'll make your work better, but
yeah,
you know, errors will still crop up.
I think it was whoever it was earlier, half an hour ago, who said all game designs survive right up until first contact with the players. So you want that first contact, and I mean the very first time you run it will be the biggest learning opportunity. So at least one or two or three times, and if you have the opportunity, conventions are nowadays online. You're gonna learn so much about your scenario that it's a really fascinating experience.
Yeah, totally agree. Viewers, if you have any ideas of ways to test your game rules or your scenarios that we have not touched on, please leave us a note in the comments. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe that will spin up additional conversations on this very fascinating topic. So leave us some comments and that's it. Leave us some comments, please.
Yeah, and while you're there, look for the links that we've got in the YouTube description for testing that we and I have done in the past and kind of our philosophy towards that. And don't forget that you can like and follow and subscribe to us, the Wandering DMs, on places like YouTube and Twitch and Twitter and Facebook and also GitHub if you're a software person. And we do have the handle Wandering DMs on all of those sites. For look for us there for updates.
If you prefer to listen to us in audio-only podcast format, my apologies, because we're really behind in releasing those. They are available on our website at wanderingdms.com and through other sites such as Google Podcasts and iTunes and Spotify. We will catch up. I've got a raft of them to release. Those are coming out very soon, so hang tight. If you do listen to us on one of those other third-party sites, please take a moment to rate and review us there. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
Yeah, we really do. And of course, huge thanks to our patrons who support the Wandering DMs shows. And if you're in a position and you would like to join them, please do visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And we have a couple different tiers. We have discounts on our merch, access to a private Discord server, monthly behind-the-scenes videos, polls, and surveys, and also after-party chat that we have in about 10 minutes after every Sunday episode. Paul is back Monday with more 10 Dead Rats, I think. And don't forget, of course, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time, so we hope that you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.